unsurpassed clarity, studying questions ranging from the possible existence of planets around nearby stars to the origin and fate of the universe. Planetary probes from close range explore the gorgeous array of other worlds in our solar system, comparing their fates with ours. All of these activities are forward-looking, hopeful, stirring, and cost-effective. None of them requires, quote, manned spaceflight. A key issue facing the future of NASA and addressed in this book is whether the purported justifications for human spaceflight are coherent and sustainable. Is it worth the cost? But first, let's consider the visions of a hopeful future, vouchsafed by robot spacecraft out among the planets. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are the ships that opened the solar system for the human species, trailblazing a path for future generations. Before their launch in August and September 1977, we were almost wholly ignorant about most of the planetary part of the solar system. In the next dozen years, they provided our first detailed close-up information on many new worlds, some of them previously known only as fuzzy disks in the eyepieces of ground-based telescopes, some merely as points of light, and some whose very existence was unsuspected. They are still returning reams of data. These spacecraft have taught us about the wonders of other worlds, about the uniqueness and fragility of our own, about beginnings and ends. They have given us access to most of the solar system, both in extent and in mass. They are the ships that first explored what may be homelands of our remote descendants. U.S. launch vehicles are these days too feeble to get such a spacecraft to Jupiter and beyond in only a few years by rocket propulsion alone. But if we're clever and lucky, there's something else we can do. We can, as the Galileo spacecraft also did years later, fly close to one world and have its gravity fling us on to the next. A gravity assist, it's called. It costs us almost nothing but ingenuity. It's something like grabbing hold of a post on a moving merry-go-round as it passes to speed you up and fling you in some new direction. The spacecraft's acceleration is compensated for by a deceleration in the planet's orbital motion around the sun. But because the planet is so massive compared to the spacecraft, it slows down hardly at all. Each Voyager spacecraft picked up a velocity boost of nearly 40,000 miles per hour from Jupiter's gravity. Jupiter, in turn, was slowed down in its motion around the sun. By how much? 5 billion years from now, when our sun becomes a swollen red giant, Jupiter will be 1 millimeter short of where it would have been had Voyager not flown by it in the late 20th century. Voyager 2 took advantage of a rare lining up of the planets. A close flyby of Jupiter accelerated it on to Saturn, Saturn to Uranus, Uranus to Neptune, and Neptune to the stars. But you can't do this anytime you like. The previous opportunity for such a game of celestial billiards presented itself during the presidency of Thomas Jefferson. We were then only at the horseback, canoe, and sailing ship stage of exploration. Steamboats were the transforming new technology just around the corner. Since adequate funds were unavailable, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, could afford to build a spacecraft that would work reliably only as far as Saturn. Beyond that, all bets were off. However, because of the brilliance of the engineering design and the fact that the JPL engineers who radioed instructions up to the spacecraft got smarter faster than the spacecraft got stupid, both spacecraft went on to explore Uranus and Neptune. These days, they are broadcasting back discoveries from beyond the most distant known planet of the sun. We tend to hear much more about the splendors returned than the ships that brought them or the shipwrights. It has always been that way. Even those history books enamored of the voyages of Christopher Columbus do not tell us much about the builders of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, or about the principal of the caravel. These spacecraft, their designers, builders, navigators, and controllers are examples of what science and engineering, set free for well-defined, peaceful purposes, can accomplish. Those scientists and engineers should be role models for an America seeking excellence and international competitiveness. They should be on our stamps. At each of the four giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, one or both spacecraft studied the planet itself, its rings, and its moons. At Jupiter in 1979, they braved a dose of trapped, charged particles 1,000 times more intense than what it takes to kill a human. Enveloped in all that radiation, they discovered the rings of the largest planet, the first active volcanoes outside Earth, and a possible underground ocean on an airless world, among a host of surprising discoveries. At Saturn in 1980 and 81, they survived a blizzard of ice and found not a few new rings, but thousands. They examined frozen moons mysteriously melted in the comparatively recent past, and a large world with a putative ocean of liquid hydrocarbons surmounted by clouds of organic matter. On January 25, 1986, Voyager 2 entered the Uranus system and reported a procession of wonders. The encounter lasted only a few hours, but the data faithfully relayed back to Earth have revolutionized our knowledge of the aquamarine planet, its 15 moons, its pitch-black rings, and its belt of trapped, high-energy, charged particles. On August 25, 1989, Voyager 2 swept through the Neptune system and observed, dimly illuminated by the distant sun, kaleidoscopic cloud patterns and a bizarre moon on which plumes of fine organic particles were being blown about by the astonishingly thin air. And in 1992, having flown beyond the outermost known planet, both Voyagers picked up radio emission thought to emanate from the still remote heliopause, the place where the wind from the sun gives way to the wind from the stars. Because we're stuck on Earth, we're forced to peer at distant worlds through an ocean of distorting air. Much of the ultraviolet, infrared, and radio waves they emit do not penetrate our atmosphere. It's easy to see why our spacecraft have revolutionized the study of the solar system. We ascend to stark clarity in the vacuum of space, and there approach our objectives, flying past them as did Voyager, or orbiting them, or landing on their surfaces. These spacecraft have returned 4 trillion bits of information to Earth, the equivalent of about 100,000 encyclopedia volumes. I described the Voyager's 1 and 2 encounters with the Jupiter system and cosmos. In the following pages, I'll say something about the Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune encounters. Just before Voyager 2 was to encounter the Uranus system, the mission design had specified a final maneuver, a brief firing of the onboard propulsion system to position the spacecraft correctly so that it could thread its way on a preset path among the hurtling moons. But the course correction proved unnecessary. The spacecraft was already within 200 kilometers of its design trajectory after a journey along an arcing path 5 billion kilometers long. This is roughly the equivalent of throwing a pin through the eye of a needle 50 kilometers away, or firing your rifle in Washington and hitting the bullseye in Dallas. Motherloads of planetary treasure were radioed back to Earth. But Earth is so far away that by the time the signal from Neptune was gathered in by radio telescopes on our planet, the received power was only 10 to the minus 16th watts, 15 zeros between the decimal point and the one. This weak signal bears the same proportion to the power emitted by an ordinary reading lamp as the diameter of an atom bears to the distance from the Earth to the Moon. It's like hearing an amoeba's footstep. The mission was conceived during the late 1960s. It was first funded in 1972, but it was not approved in its final form, including the encounters with Uranus and Neptune, until after the ships had completed their reconnaissance of Jupiter. The two spacecraft were lifted off the Earth by a non-reusable Titan Centaur booster configuration. Weighing about a ton, a Voyager would fill a small house. Each draws about 400 watts of power, considerably less than an average American home, from a generator that converts radioactive plutonium into electricity. If it had to rely on solar energy, the available power would diminish quickly as the ship ventured farther and farther from the sun. Were it not for nuclear power, Voyager would have returned no data at all from the outer solar system, except perhaps a little from Jupiter. The flow of electricity through the innards of the spacecraft would generate enough magnetism to overwhelm a sensitive instrument that measures interplanetary magnetic fields. So the magnetometer is placed at the end of a long boom far from the offending electrical currents. With other projections, it gives Voyager a slightly porcupine appearance. Cameras, infrared and ultraviolet spectrometers, and an instrument called a photopolarimeter are on a scan platform that swivels on command so these devices can be aimed at a target world. The spacecraft must know where Earth is if the antenna is to be pointed properly and the data received back home. It also needs to know where the sun is and at least one bright star so it can orient itself in three dimensions and point properly toward any passing world. If you can't point the cameras, it does no good to be able to return pictures over billions of miles. Each spacecraft cost about as much as a single modern strategic bomber. But unlike bombers, Voyager cannot, once launched, be returned to the hangar for repairs. The ship's computers and electronics are therefore designed redundantly. Much key machinery, including the essential radio receiver, had at least one backup, waiting to be called upon should the hour of need ever arrive. When either Voyager finds itself in trouble, the computers use branch contingency tree logic to work out the appropriate course of action. If that doesn't work, the ship radios home for help. As the spacecraft journeys increasingly far from Earth, the round-trip radio travel time also increases, approaching 11 hours by the time Voyager is at the distance of Neptune. Thus, in case of emergency, the spacecraft needs to know how to put itself into a safe standby mode while awaiting instructions from Earth. As it ages, more and more failures are expected, both in its mechanical parts and in its computer system. Although there is no sign, even now, of a serious memory deterioration, some robotic Alzheimer's disease. This is not to say that Voyager is perfect. Serious, mission-threatening, white-knuckle mishaps did occur. Each time, special teams of engineers, some of whom had been with the Voyager program since its inception, were assigned to work the problem. They would study the underlying science and draw upon their previous experience with the failed subsystems. They would experiment with identical Voyager spacecraft equipment that had never been launched, or even manufacture a large number of components of the sort that failed in order to gain some statistical understanding of the failure mode. In April 1978, almost 8 months after launch, and while the ship was approaching the asteroid belt, An omitted ground command, a human error, caused Voyager 2's onboard computer to switch from the prime radio receiver to its backup. During the next ground transmission to the spacecraft, the backup receiver refused to lock onto the signal from Earth. A component called a tracking loop capacitor had failed. After 7 days in which Voyager 2 was entirely out of contact, its fault protection software suddenly commanded the backup receiver to be switched off and the prime receiver to be switched back on. Mysteriously, to this day no one knows why, the prime receiver failed moments later. It was never heard from again. To top it off, the onboard computer now foolishly insisted on using the failed primary receiver. Through an unlucky concatenation of human and robotic error, the spacecraft was now in real jeopardy. No one could think of a way to get Voyager 2 to revert to the backup receiver. Even if it did, the backup receiver couldn't receive the commands from Earth because of that failed capacitor. There were many project personnel who feared that all was lost. But after a week of obdurate unresponsiveness to all commands, instructions to switch automatically between receivers were accepted and programmed into the skittish onboard computer. During that same week, the JPL engineers designed an innovative command frequency control procedure to make sure that essential orders would be understood by the damaged backup receiver. The engineers were now able to re-communicate, at least in a rudimentary way, with the spacecraft. Unfortunately, the backup receiver now turned giddy, becoming extremely sensitive to the stray heat dumped when various components of the spacecraft powered up or down. In the following months, the JPL engineers devised and conducted tests that let them thoroughly understand the thermal implications of most spacecraft operational modes. What would prevent and what would permit receipt of commands from Earth? With this information, the backup receiver was entirely circumvented. It subsequently acquired all the commands sent from Earth on how to gather data in the Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune systems. The engineers had saved the mission. To be on the safe side, during most of Voyager 2's subsequent flight, a nominal data-taking sequence for the next planet to be encountered was always sitting in the onboard computers, should the spacecraft again become deaf to entreaties from home. Another heart-wrenching failure occurred just after Voyager 2 emerged from behind Saturn, as seen from the Earth, in August 1981. The scan platform had been moving feverishly, pointing here and there among the rings, moons, and the planet itself, during the all-too-brief moments of close approach. Suddenly, the platform jammed. A stuck scan platform is a maddening predicament. Knowing that the spacecraft is flying past wonders that have never been witnessed, that we will not see again for years or decades, and the incurious spacecraft staring fixedly off into space, ignoring everything. The scan platform is driven by actuators containing gear trains. So first, the JPL engineers ran an identical copy of a flight actuator in a simulated mission. This actuator failed after 348 turns. The actuator on the spacecraft had failed after 352 turns. The problem turned out to be a lubrication failure. Good to know. But what to do about it? Plainly, it would be impossible to overtake Voyager with an oil can. The engineers wondered whether they could restart the failed actuator by alternate heating and cooling. Maybe the resulting thermal stresses would induce the components of the actuator to expand and contract at different rates and unjam the system. They tested this notion with specially manufactured actuators in the laboratory, and then jubilantly found that in this way they could start the scan platform up again in space. Project personnel also devised ways to diagnose any additional trend toward actuator failure early enough to work around the problem. Thereafter, Voyager 2's scan platform worked perfectly. All the pictures taken in the Uranus and Neptune systems owe their existence to this work. The engineers had saved the day again. Voyagers 1 and 2 were designed to explore the Jupiter and Saturn systems only. It is true that their trajectories would carry them on past Uranus and Neptune, but officially these planets were never contemplated as targets for Voyager exploration. The spacecraft were not supposed to last that long. Because of our wish to fly close to the mystery world Titan, Voyager 1 was flung by Saturn on a path that could never encounter any other known world. It is Voyager 2 that flew on to Uranus and Neptune with brilliant success. At these immense distances, sunlight is getting progressively dimmer, and the radio signals transmitted to Earth are getting progressively fainter. These were predictable but still very serious problems that the JPL engineers and scientists also had to solve. Because of the low light levels at Uranus and Neptune, the Voyager television cameras were obliged to take long-time exposures. But the spacecraft was hurtling so fast through, say, the Uranus system at about 35,000 miles per hour, that the image would have been smeared or blurred. To compensate, the entire spacecraft had to be moved during the time exposures to cancel out the motion, like panning in the direction opposite yours while taking a photograph of a street scene from a moving car. This may sound easy, but it's not. You have to neutralize the most innocent of motions. At zero gravity, the mere start and stop of the onboard tape recorder can jiggle the spacecraft enough to smear the picture. This problem was solved by sending up commands to the spacecraft's little rocket engines called thrusters, machines of exquisite sensitivity. The little puff of gas at the start and stop of each data-taking sequence, the thrusters compensated for the tape recorder jiggle by turning the entire spacecraft just a little. To deal with the low radio power received at Earth, the engineers devised a new and more efficient way to record and transmit the data, and the radio telescopes on Earth were electronically linked together with others to increase their sensitivity. Overall, the imaging system worked by many criteria, better at Uranus and Neptune than it did at Saturn or even at Jupiter. Voyager may not yet be done exploring. There is, of course, a chance that some vital subsystem will fail tomorrow. But as far as the radioactive decay of the plutonium power source is concerned, the two Voyager spacecraft should be able to return data to Earth roughly through the year 2015. Voyager is an intelligent being, part robot, part human. It extends the human senses to far-off worlds. For simple tasks and short-term problems, it relies on its own intelligence. But for more complex tasks and longer-term problems, it turns to the collective intelligence and experience of the JPL engineers. This trend is sure to grow. The Voyagers embody the technology of the early 1970s. If spacecraft were designed for such a mission today, they would incorporate stunning advances in artificial intelligence, in miniaturization, in data processing speed, in the ability to self-diagnose and repair, and in the propensity to learn from experience. They would also be much cheaper. In the many environments too dangerous for people, on Earth as well as in space, the future belongs to robot-human partnerships that will recognize the two Voyagers as antecedents and pioneers for nuclear accidents, mine disasters, undersea exploration and archaeology, manufacturing, prowling the interiors of volcanoes, and household help. To name only a few potential applications, it could make an enormous difference to have a ready core of smart, mobile, compact, commandable robots that can diagnose and repair their own malfunctions. There are likely to be many more of this tribe in the near future. It is conventional wisdom now that anything built by the government will be a disaster. But the two Voyager spacecraft were built by the government, in partnership with that other bugaboo, academia. They came in at cost, on time, and vastly exceeded their design specifications, as well as the fondest dreams of their makers. Seeking not to control, threaten, wound, or destroy, these elegant machines represent the exploratory part of our nature, set free to roam the solar system and beyond. This kind of technology, the treasures it uncovers freely available to all humans everywhere, has been, over the last few decades, one of the few activities of the United States admired as much by those who abhor many of its policies as by those who agree with it on every issue. Voyager cost each American less than a penny a year from launch to Neptune encounter. Missions to the planets are one of those things, and I mean this not just for the United States, but for the human species, that we do best. Chapter 7. Among the Moons of Saturn. Seat thyself sultanically among the moons of Saturn. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Chapter 107, 1851. There is a world, midway in size between the moon and Mars, where the upper air is rippling with electricity, streaming in from the archetypical ring planet next door, where the perpetual brown overcast is tinged with an odd burnt orange, and where the very stuff of life falls out of the skies onto the unknown surface below. It is so far away that light takes more than an hour to get there from the sun. Spacecraft take years. Much about it is still a mystery, including whether it holds great oceans. We know just enough, though, to recognize that within reach may be a place where certain processes are today working themselves out that eons ago on Earth led to the origin of life. On our own world, a long-standing and in some respects quite promising experiment has been underway on the evolution of matter. The oldest known fossils are about 3.6 billion years old. Of course, the origin of life had to have happened well before that. But 4.2 or 4.3 billion years ago, the Earth was being so ravaged by the final stages of its formation that life could not yet have come into being. Massive collisions were melting the surface, turning the oceans into steam, and driving any atmosphere that had accumulated since the last impact off into space. So around 4 billion years ago, there was a fairly narrow window, perhaps only 100 million years wide, in which our most distant ancestors came to be. Once conditions permitted, life arose fast, somehow. The first living things very likely were inept, far less capable than the most humble microbe alive today, perhaps just barely able to make crude copies of themselves. But natural selection, the key process first coherently described by Charles Darwin, is an instrument of such enormous power that from the most modest beginnings there can emerge all the richness and beauty of the biological world. Those first living things were made of pieces, parts, building blocks, which had to come into being on their own. That is driven by the laws of physics and chemistry on a lifeless Earth. The building blocks of all terrestrial life are called organic molecules, molecules based on carbon. Of the stupendous number of possible organic molecules, very few are used at the heart of life. The two most important classes are the amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, and the nucleotide bases, the building blocks of the nucleic acids. Just before the origin of life, where did these molecules come from? There are only two possibilities, from the outside or from the inside. We know that vastly more comets and asteroids were hitting the Earth than do so today, that these small worlds are rich storehouses of complex organic molecules, and that some of these molecules escaped being fried on impact. Here, I'm describing homemade, not imported goods. The organic molecules generated in the air and waters of the primitive Earth. Unfortunately, we don't know very much about the composition of the early air, and organic molecules are far easier to make in some atmospheres than in others. There couldn't have been much oxygen, because oxygen is generated by green plants, and there weren't any green plants yet. There was probably more hydrogen, because hydrogen is very abundant in the universe, and escapes from the upper atmosphere of the Earth into space better than any other atom, because it's so light. If we can imagine various possible early atmospheres, we can duplicate them in the laboratory, supply some energy, and see which organic molecules are made and in what amounts. Such experiments have, over the years, proved provocative and promising, but our ignorance of initial conditions limits their relevance. What we need is a real world whose atmosphere still retains some of those hydrogen-rich gases, a world in other respects something like the Earth, a world in which the organic building blocks of life are being massively generated in our own time, a world we can go to seek our own beginnings. There is only one such world in the solar system. There could have been none. We're very lucky that there is such a world to study. The others all have too much hydrogen, or not enough, or no atmosphere at all. That world is Titan, the big moon of Saturn. It's about 5,150 kilometers, 3,200 miles, in diameter, a little less than half the size of the Earth. It takes 16 of our days to complete one orbit of Saturn. No world is a perfect replica of any other. And in at least one important respect, Titan is very different from the primitive Earth. Being so far from the sun, its surface is extremely cold, far below the freezing point of water, around 180 degrees below zero Celsius. So while the Earth at the time of the origin of life was, as now, mainly ocean-covered, plainly, there can be no oceans of liquid water on Titan. Oceans made of other stuff are a different story, as we shall see. The low temperatures provide an advantage, though, because once molecules are synthesized on Titan, they tend to stick around. The higher the temperature, the faster molecules fall to pieces. On Titan, the molecules that have been raining down like manna from heaven for the last 4 billion years might still be there, largely unaltered, deep frozen, awaiting the chemists from Earth. The invention of the telescope in the 17th century led to the discovery of many new worlds. In 1610, Galileo first spied the four large satellites of Jupiter. It looked like a miniature solar system, the little moons racing around Jupiter as the planets were thought by Copernicus to orbit the sun. It was another blow to the geocentrists. 45 years later, the celebrated Dutch physicist Christianus Huygens discovered a moon moving about the planet Saturn and named it Titan. It was a dot of light 1 billion miles away, gleaming in reflected sunlight. From the time of its discovery, when European men wore long curly wigs, to World War II, when American men cut their hair down to stubble, almost nothing more was discovered about Titan, except the fact it had a curious, tawny color. Ground-based telescopes could, even in principle, barely make out some enigmatic detail. The Spanish astronomer J. Comasola reported at the turn of the 20th century some faint and indirect evidence of an atmosphere. In a way, I grew up with Titan. I did my doctoral dissertation at the University of Chicago under the guidance of Gerard P. Kuiper, the astronomer who made the definitive discovery that Titan has an atmosphere. Kuiper was Dutch, and in a direct line of intellectual descent from Christianus Huygens. In 1944, while making a spectroscopic examination of Titan, Kuiper was astonished to find the characteristic spectral features of the gas methane. When he pointed the telescope at Titan, there was the signature of methane. When he pointed it away, not a hint of methane. But moons were not supposed to hold onto sizable atmospheres, and the Earth's moon certainly doesn't. Titan could retain an atmosphere, Kuiper realized, even though its gravity was less than Earth's, because its upper atmosphere is very cold. The molecules simply aren't moving fast enough for significant numbers to achieve escape velocity and trickle away to space. Daniel Harris, a student of Kuiper's, showed definitively that Titan is red. Maybe we were looking at a rusty surface like that of Mars. If you wanted to learn more about Titan, you could also measure the polarization of sunlight reflected off it. Ordinary sunlight is unpolarized. Joseph Averka, now a fellow faculty member at Cornell University, was my graduate student at Harvard University, and therefore, so to speak, a grand student of Kuiper's. In his doctoral work around 1970, he measured the polarization of Titan and found that it changed as the relative positions of Titan, the Sun, and the Earth changed. But the change was very different from that exhibited by, say, the Moon. Averka concluded that the character of this variation was consistent with extensive clouds or haze on Titan. When we looked at it through the telescope, we weren't seeing its surface. We knew nothing about what the surface was like. We had no idea how far below the clouds the surface was. So, by the early 1970s, as a kind of legacy from Huygens and his line of intellectual descent, we knew at least that Titan has a dense, methane-rich atmosphere, and that it's probably enveloped by a reddish cloud veil or aerosol haze. But what kind of cloud is red? By the early 1970s, my colleague Bishan Kari and I had been doing experiments at Cornell in which we irradiated various methane-rich atmospheres with ultraviolet light or electrons and were generating reddish or brownish solids. The stuff would coat the interiors of our reaction vessels. It seemed to me that if methane-rich Titan had red-brown clouds, those clouds might very well be similar to what we were making in the laboratory. We called this material tholen, after a Greek word for muddy. At the beginning, we had very little idea what it was made of. It was some organic stew made by breaking apart our starting molecules and allowing the atoms, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and molecular fragments to recombine. The word organic carries no imputation of biological origin. Following long-standing chemical usage dating back more than a century, it merely describes molecules built out of carbon atoms. Excluding a few very simple ones, such as carbon monoxide, CO, and carbon dioxide, CO2. Since life on Earth is based on organic molecules, and since there was a time before there was life on Earth, some process must have made organic molecules on our planet before the time of the first organism. Something similar, I proposed, might be happening on Titan today. The epical event in our understanding of Titan was the arrival in 1980 and 1981 of the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecraft in the Saturn system. The ultraviolet, infrared, and radio instruments revealed the pressure and temperature through the atmosphere, from the hidden surface to the edge of space. We learned how high the cloud tops are. We found that the air on Titan is composed mainly of nitrogen, N2, as on the Earth today. The other principal constituent is, as Kuiper found, methane, CH4, the starting material from which carbon-based organic molecules are generated there. A variety of simple organic molecules was found, present as gases, mainly hydrocarbons and nitriles. The most complex of them have four heavy carbon and/or nitrogen atoms. Hydrocarbons are molecules composed of carbon and hydrogen atoms only, and are familiar to us as natural gas, petroleum, and waxes. They're quite different from carbohydrates, such as sugars and starch, which also have oxygen atoms. Nitriles are molecules with a carbon and nitrogen atom attached in a particular way. The best known nitrile is HCN, hydrogen cyanide, a deadly gas for humans. But hydrogen cyanide is implicated in the steps that on Earth led to the origin of life. Finding these simple organic molecules in Titan's upper atmosphere, even if present only in a part per million or a part per billion, is tantalizing. Could the atmosphere of the primeval Earth have been similar? There's about 10 times more air on Titan than there is on Earth today. But the early Earth may well have had a denser atmosphere. Moreover, Voyager discovered an extensive region of energetic electrons and protons surrounding Saturn, trapped by the planet's magnetic field. During the course of its orbital motion around Saturn, Titan bobs in and out of this magnetosphere. Beams of electrons, plus solar ultraviolet light, fall on the upper air of Titan, just as charged particles, plus solar ultraviolet light, were intercepted by the atmosphere of the primitive Earth. So it's a natural thought to irradiate the appropriate mixture of nitrogen and methane with ultraviolet light or electrons at very low pressures and find out what more complex molecules can be made. Can we simulate what's going on in Titan's high atmosphere? In our laboratory at Cornell, with my colleague W. Reed Thompson playing a key role, we've replicated some of Titan's manufacture of organic gases. The simplest hydrocarbons on Titan are manufactured by ultraviolet light from the sun. But for all the other gas products, those made most readily by electrons in the laboratory, correspond to those discovered by Voyager on Titan and in the same proportions. The correspondence is 1:1. The next most abundant gases that we found in the laboratory will be looked for in future studies of Titan. The most complex organic gases we make have 6 or 7 carbon and/or nitrogen atoms. These product molecules are on their way to forming tholins. We had hoped for a break in the weather as Voyager 1 approached Titan. A long distance away, it appeared as a tiny disk. At closest approach, our camera's field of view was filled by a small province of Titan. If there had been a break in the haze and clouds, even only a few miles across, as we scanned the disk, we would have seen something of its hidden surface. But there was no hint of a break. This world is socked in. No one on Earth knows what's on Titan's surface. And an observer there, looking up in ordinary visible light, would have no idea of the glories that await upon ascending through the haze and beholding Saturn and its magnificent rings. From measurements by Voyager, by the International Ultraviolet Explorer Observatory in Earth orbit, and by ground-based telescopes, we know a fair amount about the orange-brown haze particles that obscure the surface. which colors of light they like to absorb, which colors they pretty much let pass through them, how much they bend the light that does pass through them, and how big they are. They're mostly the size of the particles in cigarette smoke. The optical properties will depend, of course, on the composition of the haze particles. In collaboration with Edward Arakara of Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, Kare and I have measured the optical properties of Titan tholin. It turns out to be a dead ringer for the real Titan haze. No other candidate material, mineral or organic, matches the optical constants of Titan. So we can fairly claim to have bottled the haze of Titan, formed high in its atmosphere, slowly falling out and accumulating in copious amounts on its surface. What is this stuff made of? It's very hard to know the exact composition of a complex organic solid. For example, the chemistry of coal is still not fully understood, despite a long-standing economic incentive. But we found out some things about Titan tholin. It contains many of the essential building blocks of life on Earth. Indeed, if you drop Titan tholin into water, you make a large number of amino acids, the fundamental constituents of proteins and nucleotide bases also, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. Some of the amino acids so formed are widespread in living things on Earth. Others are of a completely different sort. A rich array of other organic molecules is present also, some relevant to life, some not. During the past 4 billion years, immense quantities of organic molecules sedimented out of the atmosphere onto the surface of Titan. If it's all deep frozen and unchanged in the intervening eons, the amount accumulated should be at least tens of meters, 100 feet thick. Outside estimates put it at a kilometer deep. But at 180 degrees Celsius below the freezing point of water, you might very well think that amino acids will never be made. Dropping tholins into water may be relevant to the early Earth, but not, it would seem, to Titan. However, comets and asteroids must on occasion come crashing into the surface of Titan. The other nearby moons of Saturn show abundant impact craters, and the atmosphere of Titan isn't thick enough to prevent large, high-speed objects from reaching the surface. Although we've never seen the surface of Titan, planetary scientists nevertheless know something about its composition. The average density of Titan lies between the density of ice and the density of rock. Plausibly, it contains both. Ice and rock are abundant on nearby worlds, some of which are made of nearly pure ice. If the surface of Titan is icy, a high-speed cometary impact will temporarily melt the ice. Thompson and I estimate that any given spot on Titan's surface has a better than 50-50 chance of having once been melted, with an average lifetime of the impact, melt, and slurry of almost 1,000 years. This makes a very different story. The origin of life on Earth seems to have occurred in oceans and shallow tide pools. Life on Earth is made mainly of water, which plays an essential physical and chemical role. Indeed, it's hard for us water-besotted creatures to imagine life without water. If on our planet the origin of life took less than 100 million years, is there any chance that on Titan it took 1,000? With tholins mixed into liquid water, even for only 1,000 years, the surface of Titan may be much further along toward the origin of life than we thought. Despite all this, we understand pitifully little about Titan. This was brought home forcefully to me at a scientific symposium on Titan, held in Toulouse, France, and sponsored by the European Space Agency, ESA. While oceans of liquid water are impossible on Titan, Oceans of liquid hydrocarbons are not. Clouds of methane, CH4, the most abundant hydrocarbon, are expected not far above the surface. Ethane, C2H6, the next most abundant hydrocarbon, must condense out at the surface in the same way that water vapor becomes a liquid near the surface of the Earth, where the temperature is generally between the freezing and melting points. Vast oceans of liquid hydrocarbons should have accumulated over the lifetime of Titan. They would lie far beneath the haze and clouds. But that doesn't mean they would be wholly inaccessible to us, because radio waves readily penetrate the atmosphere of Titan, and it's suspended, slowly falling, fine particles. In Toulouse, Dwayne O. Mullman of the California Institute of Technology described to us the very difficult technical feat of transmitting a set of radio pulses from a radio telescope in California's Mojave Desert, so they reach Titan, penetrate through the haze and clouds to its surface, are reflected back into space, and then return to Earth. Here, the greatly enfeebled signal is picked up by an array of radio telescopes near Socorro, New Mexico. Great. If Titan has a rocky or icy surface, a radar pulse reflected off its surface should be detectable on Earth. But if Titan were covered with hydrocarbon oceans, Mullman shouldn't see a thing. Liquid hydrocarbons are black to these radio waves, and no echo would have been returned to Earth. In fact, Mullman's giant radar system sees a reflection when some longitudes of Titan are turned toward Earth, and not at other longitudes. All right, you might say. So Titan has oceans and continents, and it was a continent that reflected the signals back to Earth. But if Titan is in this respect like the Earth, for some meridians, through Europe and Africa, say, mainly continent, and for others, through the Central Pacific, say, mainly ocean, then we must confront another problem. The orbit of Titan around Saturn is not a perfect circle. It's notably squashed out or elliptical. If Titan has extensive oceans, though, the giant planet Saturn around which it orbits will raise substantial tides on Titan, and the resulting tidal friction will circularize Titan's orbit in much less than the age of the solar system. In a 1982 scientific paper called The Tide in the Seas of Titan, Stanley Dermott, now at the University of Florida, and I argued that for this reason, Titan must be either an all-ocean or an all-land world. Otherwise, the tidal friction in places where the ocean is shallow would have taken its toll. Lakes and islands might be permitted, but anything more, and Titan would have a very different orbit than the one we see. We have, then, three scientific arguments. One concluding that this world is almost entirely covered with hydrocarbon oceans. Another that it's a mix of continents and oceans. And a third requiring us to choose, counseling that Titan can't have extensive oceans and extensive continents at the same time. It will be interesting to see what the answer turns out to be. What I've just told you is a kind of scientific progress report. Tomorrow there might be a new finding that clears up these mysteries and contradictions. Maybe there's something wrong with Mullman's radar results, although it's hard to see what it might be. His system tells him he's seeing Titan when it's nearest, when he ought to be seeing Titan. Maybe there's something wrong with Dermott's and my calculation about the tidal evolution of the orbit of Titan. But no one has been able to find any errors so far. And it's hard to see how ethane can avoid condensing out at the surface of Titan. Maybe despite the low temperatures over billions of years, there's been a change in the chemistry. Maybe some combination of comets impacting from the sky and volcanoes and other tectonic events helped along by cosmic rays, can congeal liquid hydrocarbons, turning them into some complex organic solid that reflects radio waves back to space. Or maybe something reflective to radio waves is floating on the ocean surface. But liquid hydrocarbons are very underdense. Every known organic solid, unless extremely frothy, would sink like a stone in the seas of Titan. Dermot and I now wonder whether, when we imagined continents and oceans on Titan, we were too transfixed by our experience on our own world, too Earth chauvinist in our thinking. Battered, cratered terrain and abundant impact basins cover other moons in the Saturn system. If we pictured liquid hydrocarbons slowly accumulating on one of those worlds, we would wind up not with global oceans, but with isolated large craters filled, although not to the brim, with liquid hydrocarbons. Many circular seas of petroleum, some over 100 miles across, would be splattered across the surface. But no perceptible waves would be stimulated by distant Saturn, and it is conventional to think no ships, no swimmers, no surfers, and no fishing. Tidal friction should, we calculate, be negligible in such a case, and Titan's stretched-out elliptical orbit would not have become so circular. We can't know for sure until we start getting radar or near-infrared images of the surface. But perhaps this is the resolution of our dilemma. Titan as a world of large, circular hydrocarbon lakes. More of them in some longitudes than in others. Should we expect an icy surface covered with deep tholin sediments, a hydrocarbon ocean with at most a few organic encrusted islands poking up here and there, a world of crater lakes, or something more subtle that we haven't yet figured out? This isn't just an academic question, because there's a real spacecraft being designed to go to Titan. In a joint NASA-European Space Agency program, a spacecraft called Cassini will be launched in October 1997, if all goes well. With two flybys of Venus, one of Earth, and one of Jupiter for gravitational assists, the ship will, after a 7-year voyage, be injected into orbit around Saturn. Each time the spacecraft comes close to Titan, the moon will be examined by an array of instruments, including radar. Because Cassini will be so much closer to Titan, it will be able to resolve many details on Titan's surface indetectable to Mulman's pioneering Earth-based system. It's also likely that the surface can be viewed in the near-infrared. Maps of the hidden surface of Titan may be in our hands sometime in the summer of 2004. Cassini is also carrying an entry probe, fittingly called Huygens, which will detach itself from the main spacecraft and plummet into Titan's atmosphere. A great parachute will be deployed. The instrument package will slowly settle through the organic haze down into the lower atmosphere through the methane clouds. It will examine organic chemistry as it descends, and if it survives the landing, on the surface of this world as well. Nothing is guaranteed, but the mission is technically feasible. Hardware is being built, an impressive coterie of specialists, including many young European scientists, are hard at work on it, and all the nations responsible seem committed to the project. Perhaps it will actually come about. Perhaps, winging across the billion miles of intervening interplanetary space will be, in the not-too-distant future, news about how far along the path to life Titan has come. Chapter 8, The First New Planet. I implore you, You do not hope to be able to give the reasons for the number of planets, do you? This worry has been resolved.